Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Welcome back to the latest edition of The Audible, presented by Trader Joe's. I'm Bruce Feldman, joined as always by my colleagues Stuart Mandel and Stu. This weekend we have actual games. It is officially week zero week. And the biggest game of all, for at least our week zero, is going to be Illinois and Nebraska kicking it all off. And what better way to get it started before we get into the mailbag and get into Stu's Big Ten predictions. We're going to talk to an actual Big Ten expert, is former Ohio State star linebacker Joshua Perry from Big Ten Network, who was out on the road and visited every Big Ten program in camp and has a lot of insight. We're really glad that he has found time to join us today on the Audible.
We are pleased to be joined now by Joshua Perry from the Big Ten Network. You remember him from Ohio State's 2014 National Championship team. He now is part of that crew at BTN with Dave Revson, Jerry DiNardo, Howard Griffith. And we love, every preseason, we love checking in with you guys because you get to go to all 14 schools, see what's going on during preseason camp. And we are literally on a Zoom right now and you're in your car. I did not realize you guys don't have the bus this year. How is this tour working exactly?
Yes, we are busless. So we have been just kind of doing it the way you would do it, hopping on planes, getting in cars. We even thought about taking a train at one point to get from stop to stop. This has not been without issues, though. And some of them started early on. We had some trouble leaving our third stop. We were coming from Wisconsin. We were supposed to be heading to East Lansing. There was some weather, had a flight issue, ended up making that a drive. And then we pulled a similar thing when we were leaving, I believe Penn State, instead of hopping on the plane, cause that was getting delayed. We drove to Rutgers, which wasn't a bad drive. And then we had the weekend at home. So I'm leaving Columbus and heading over to Purdue right now, which is about a 4-hour trip. So we've been able to manage, got to figure it out. And it's been fun. We got to see a lot of different things that we obviously didn't get to see last year in preseason. So it's really insightful.
So you are based, obviously, as people know, you were a great player at Ohio State, and you've been with BTN for a little while now. Getting to eyeball teams in camp, give us like maybe your two or three biggest, whoa, I didn't expect that, from getting to see some of these programs.
Yeah, I mean, that's a wonderful question. I think it starts with Minnesota, who was our most recent stop. So maybe that's a little bit of recency bias, but we just had no idea what to expect from that team after 2020. Because they had so many issues. They had so many guys out for COVID issues. Tanner Morgan, their quarterback, had some family issues that he was dealing with. And I know it's not easy to play football when you're dealing with some outside issues, but especially the quarterback position. And so we didn't know if they were going to be more what we saw in 2019 or what we saw in 2020. And I can tell you right now, I think it's more 2019. I think Tanner Morgan's going to be a lot better. They've got 10 guys on defense who played a lot last year, and a lot of those guys weren't supposed to play. They look really good. I think they're going to be strong there. Both lines of scrimmage are just looking, I can't even describe it. Like, they've got real guys out there physically. So I think they're going to be good. The other one was Indiana, just because of the same kind of curiosity. Are they going to be able to continue this upward trend that they've had over the last couple of seasons? And the answer is yes. And for two reasons is number one, they've got plenty of talent, but number two, that's a coaching staff that has standards. They're demanding. They know how to teach. And they're going to coach the best out of players. So if they have any issues this year, it won't be for a lack of coaching or a lack of talent. I think it's a really well put together program. The final one, and we'll get to see them in week zero, is Illinois. And when we were leaving Big Ten Media Days, that was the spot where I said, I'm the most curious, because you had no idea what things were going to look like. You could guess based off of what Brett Bielema has done in the past, but you just didn't know. And they've got a veteran quarterback who is a very talented player who probably makes a few too many mistakes, and he's got to tighten that up. They're going to be good along the lines of scrimmage. I love what they have at running back. I think they've got really good linebackers. But their X factor is Brett Bielema got to spend time around Bill Belichick in the NFL. And if there's one coach that you would want to spend some time around from the NFL, it's that guy. And I think he picked up some really good habits. I think he really understood what Bill does as a coach and how he thinks about the game differently. And he's trying to give that to his team. So those three teams in Minnesota, Indiana, and Illinois really kind of stood out to me.
Okay, I'm immediately regretting my 3-9 pick for the Illini. Whoops.
22 super seniors, right?
Yeah.
Joshua, 22 super seniors.
They're a really veteran team.
Well, okay, so if those three schools, and certainly Illinois and Minnesota, could get a lot better record-wise, Indiana, you're saying, might be even better. Somebody's got to take a step back. Who would that be?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough, right? And you ask the question, of course, and I'm a Buckeye, so people are going to say, of course, he says that, but he asked a question about Michigan, and they've got a new defensive coordinator and a new system that they're trying to implement. I think there's still a question of is the offense going to be more Josh Gattis, or is it going to be more Jim Harbaugh? They've got Cade McNamara, who's going to be starting football games, and I think that he is a very good starting level college quarterback. You know, he's a guy who maybe isn't the most flashy on tape. I think he's a smart player who's going to limit mistakes, which is something that they need. They've had a lot of mistakes at that position. But you leave there feeling like this team is ultimately talented enough to be exactly what they want to be in the East. But I don't know if you feel like they've put every single thing together in terms of they're ready to take the next step. I think the players are excited. I think the coaching staff looked organized, but you just left there kind of missing that bit of excitement that you got at other places. So that would be my team in the East. It hurts for me to say this, but in the West, I think Northwestern's success, now that they've lost Cam Porter at running back, is going to be largely dependent upon what they can do at the quarterback position. And that's a place that they've struggled over the last handful of years. If it wasn't for Peyton Ramsey making a transfer after Mike Penix had the success that he had at Indiana, I'm not exactly sure what that team would have looked like a year ago. And I'm hoping that those guys are able to put things together. And there were three guys to me at practice that stood out for some really good things, but also looked like players who didn't have a ton of game experience. So they're the one that's kind of the enigma to me. I think they can be solid because that's just what Pat Fitzgerald does. I think the daggone defense is going to be really good. It's just like, and you can say this for a lot of teams, but like the quarterback position is always going to be so important. And I think for them, it's going to be really important this year.
Okay. I want to pivot to a school we don't talk too much about, but it's one that I think, and we haven't talked about this offline, but I think it's one that you may light up a little bit about, and they don't get much respect. It's Rutgers,
yep.
Right? So Noah Vedral transferred in from Nebraska. I think he did a nice job, but they have what I would categorize, and I watched what you guys did on BTN. You guys like the skill guys, right? So I'm not saying it's like he's got, you know, Brian Hartline's receiver room there, but what do you think of the skill talent, and how decent can Rutgers be in 2021?
Yeah, I mean, the skill there, I think they've done a really good job. And it's guys that have been there, too. It's not like they had a ton of upgrades and brought in a bunch of, you know, college free agents out of the portal or whatever it was. It's Isaiah Pacheco, who's been there for years. We've been calling his name for years. He's been productive for years. It's Aaron Cruickshank, who's been there for a couple years now, but he was really productive at Wisconsin. I think he's really coming into his own as a wide receiver there at Rutgers. It's Bo Melton, who's a guy that we all have talked about as one of the best receivers in the Big Ten Conference. And like you said, Noah Vedral, who is a guy who has some experience under his belt and some battle wounds and some scars that I think has made him kind of shift his paradigm on how he thinks about the game as a leader and a quarterback. I also think defensively, they look as good as they have up front. And they've got a couple of guys, Izian in their secondary, I think is going to be a phenomenal player. And they've got Fadakasi, who is one of the top linebackers in the conference. I think he's going to be wonderful as well. Greg Schiano was in a really unique position at Ohio State because I think he was still in the NFL paradigm where his defensive inventory, the playbook, was really big. And I think he felt the pressure that people feel in Columbus and kind of weighed on him mentally and just how he was able to interact with the players. Now he's in a place where he's super comfortable, where he's had a ton of success, and I think he's renewed just in terms of his energy. That is a team where you don't know exactly what they're going to do because they still got a ways to go, but they will be in some games they probably shouldn't be in simply because I think they're well coached and they're going to be tougher than most of the people they face on their schedule.
It's interesting that point, because when you said that about Schiano at Ohio State, I remember being a sideline guy and in between drives, you know, where like you have a lot of the, you know, the phones and basically an area where the players usually don't congregate because it's just, there's just a lot of like stuff there. Greg would almost be huddled there with like his hands around his head, around his eyes, like kind of tunnel visioning it. He might be on the phone with like Bob Frazier, who's now with him.
Yep.
Like he was his guy.
Yep.
And he's with him at Rutgers. And I just remember thinking it was like, it just seems like there's a lot of clutter right here, right
okay.
now, in terms of he had all those great players at Ohio State. And I think it was maybe a different transition for him sorting it out from going from NFL to there.
Let's talk about that for a sec, because we talked to Greg and I love him to death. I got to know him as a former player coming back and just watching practices and stuff. And he's just as genuine of a guy. Like, he didn't owe me anything and, you know, just spent time talking to me and kind of walking me through what his philosophies were and everything. But when I was speaking to him most recently, he's like, you know, I'm a guy who's a tunnel vision guy. The literal words you said, when it comes to reading and diagnosing and breaking down and making adjustments. And so his preference was to be up in the booth during games. He wanted to be in the press box so he could see everything develop. And it's a very quiet environment up there. The chaos is done. And Urban wanted him to really be down there on the field because he felt like his presence and his leadership was useful down there. And I don't disagree with that. But I think for Greg, it was really difficult sometimes being right there in the fray, making adjustments in the middle of the game from the sideline. So, I mean, it's a really interesting thing. And I think that experience helped him grow as a coach, obviously, in a lot of ways. But you're so right. Like, he is a guy who is hyper-focused, and he sees a little bit differently. But I truly think that he is in the best place that he can be, and his players have bought into everything that he's given them.
In terms of your alma mater, I feel like when we talk about Ohio State going into a season, it's not like there's a wide range of possibilities. But with a new quarterback taking over, with some lingering questions from the defense last season, from what you saw, did you see more of a finished product, this team's ready to contend for a national championship kind of Ohio State team, or one that has some actual question marks going into a season?
Yeah, it was interesting because when we went, CJ was kind of on a load management, CJ Stroud type of deal. So he was getting some reps, but he wasn't getting a ton of reps. All of the reps that he was in there for, he looked efficient. He looked confident, the whole deal. And it's really hard to not feel that way when you've got Garrett Wilson and Chris Olave as some of the veterans. And then you look even to some of the younger players and you've got like a Marvin Harrison Jr. type of guy who's going to be really good as a freshman and an experienced O-line coming back. I think the offense is as good as offenses that we've seen recently. I don't think there's any way that it takes a true step back. And that's without even mentioning the running back room, which I think has three guys, maybe four, that can really roll. As I look defensively, I think the upgrade has come in terms of health in the secondary and some guys back now that have played a little bit and have some experience and can use some of those battle scars that they had from last year and those calluses to not make the same mistakes. And across the defensive line, which I think will be able to more effectively rush the passer this year. And I think the criticism falls a lot on the secondary from a year ago. And I can't argue that because they were lackluster in a lot of situations. But you can also flip that and say that there was no Joey Bosa, no Nick Bosa, no Chase Young type player to force a quarterback into errors that other secondaries have had work to their benefit. And so now you've got a Zach Harrison type player who was supposed to be a breakout star. You've got a guy like Haskell Garrett who can rush from the interior, who's back. And I think that it's a real upgrade that helps the secondary out because now quarterbacks are going to be under duress and forced into bad situations.
Joshua, you were on that national title team that Urban Meyer had. You came in, you were part of the different regime, then he came in, and you became one of the leaders on that team. I'm curious, you're around the program now as a media member, as a former Ohio State player as well. How different is the vibe inside the building with what you played under with Urban compared to now with Ryan Day, who was on his staff at the end, but has obviously put his own spin on it?
Yeah, it's so different. And I think there's multiple ways to get it done. And that's the beautiful thing about this game is I think Ryan has found something that really works and that the players have taken to and that the coaches love to operate under where, you know, when you walk into the facility, it's not go time all the time, and it's just a little bit more comfortable to be there. But he also will apply the pressure as soon as it needs to be applied and ramp up that energy. Urban's deal was, and this is part of what made him elite, is every moment you were in the facility, it was fourth and goal from the 1 yard line. You know, it's you got to make the big stop or you got to score. And we would walk in during training camp, and Mickey Marotti, who's the head strength coach, would be at the player's entrance of the Woody. And you would walk in, and if you were walking in alone, he'd make you wait until somebody else walked in. And then he would make you race to see who could drink a bottle of Gatorade the fastest. And we're talking like 6 a.m. He's making you compete against somebody else. So, you know, it's a competition, but it's also like he's making you think about hydration the moment you walk in. And so now there's a million things thrown at you and you're like on edge. And being on edge is a great way to make sure that you don't make mistakes. But at the same time, I think that the way that Ryan's doing it has been a good balance because there's still some players who are used to always being on edge now that can catch their breath. And I think it's given them a renewed sense of confidence and a renewed sense of enjoyment from being around the Woody. It's wild, though. And I give Gene Smith all the credit in the world for being able to go out and hire Urban Meyer, which I think was obvious at the time, but then follow that up with Ryan Day. Like, you know, I think the biggest reason some blue bloods fall off is because of coaching hires, and Gene's done a great job with it.
One other program in the East that I think a lot of people are curious about is Penn State. Last year, everything that could go wrong went wrong, and they started 0-5. And at that point, you had to wonder, oh, has there been a big talent drop-off at Penn State that we weren't aware of, or is this just opt-outs and injuries and whatnot? Seeing them in this preseason, and I should also add, in the years leading up to that, that the perception was they were so close to Ohio State. I mean, they played 3 years in a row. It's always come down to 1 point. Where is that gap right now in your mind?
Yeah, it was a rough year, I think, for Penn State last year. I don't think that the recruiting rankings, I don't know if they fully tell the story, because you look at physically what the players look like and how they move around and everything. And you wouldn't say that the recruiting had dropped off just by some of the bodies that they have out there. I think that they are the one team in the Big Ten Conference that you feel like can almost match Ohio State in terms of speed. Like, they're the closest in terms of being able to close that speed gap that Ohio State has right now, which is great. You look at their secondary, they're lengthy, so they'll be able to match up on the edges. They've got guys at linebacker who can run and hit, which is awesome. The biggest thing for me when I evaluate that roster is what Sean Clifford is going to look like. And you got to give him the benefit of the doubt, because I made the comment that I don't think the quarterback was necessarily where you wanted him to be at the point in training camp that we saw him. And a lot of people on Twitter were like, oh man, well, he's been a 3-year starter and how can he not look good? And he just must suck in the set and the third. And it's like, no, he's had 3 coordinators in 3 seasons. That is the worst position to have 3 coordinators in 3 seasons. You have to know everything that's going on from the offensive line to the running backs, to the tight ends, to the wide receivers, to the quarterback position itself. You have to learn how to speak multiple different languages just in terms of the terminology that come with the different playbooks. You have to be in tune now to another guy and how he likes to call a game and game scenarios and everything else. Like, that is one of the biggest things that can hurt the development of a quarterback. And so it's not his fault that he maybe isn't totally up to speed. You just hope that he can hit that learning curve sooner rather than later and go out there and make plays the way we saw him do a couple years ago. That would be my one thing. Everywhere else, I think they're pretty damn good. They got Jahan Dotson, who I think is one of the top guys in the conference overall. They've got 4 guys at running back who are going to be able to roll. I talked about their defense already. Like, it's going to be a good team. It'll just be, can your quarterback go out there and ball out the way that he did a few years ago?
All right, last question for you. The season kicks off. Biggest game of week 0. The Illinois team you talked about earlier against Scott Frost and Nebraska, and there's a lot of eyeballs on the Huskers. Are you buying that the program can take a big step? Adrian Martinez has been there for a long time. Are you buying the Huskers, and what should we expect from this game in week 0?
It's a really great question, because I think this goes to the thing that I've talked about before that you can probably apply to most of the schools in the conference. What's the quarterback play going to be? Because you've got Peters and Martinez, who are both players I think can make a ton of plays, but they're both players who have also made some mistakes and they've turned the ball over. So something's got to break there. The biggest difference for me is I feel like Illinois is a squad that is reinvigorated, who has a head coach that is thinking on a different plane right now. And what I mean by that is all the things that he learned from being around one of the greatest coaches to ever do it, and Bill Belichick, he's trying to figure out what level he needs to give to his team and his coaching staff so they can take the next step. And I think that he's playing with house money just in terms of going out there and trying to put the best product on the field, whereas Nebraska is probably going to be a lot tighter. You know, they understand that things are a little bit more urgent. Scott Frost, there's, you know, all the investigation stuff and different things going on within his program. Is just a different feel between the two. And so if I had to make a prediction, I had to give an edge, I would say that this is a pretty talent equated game on the field. Just when you look at chess pieces, I think that the intangibles probably lean toward Illinois to go out there in maybe a little bit of a better headspace as a program and edge out a win that way. This is huge for Scott Frost, because if he can pull off a win, I think it's going to change the paradigm in which we talk about Nebraska football early on in the year, which he needs. If he loses this game, it's going to be really tough. It's going to be difficult. Media, I think people around the program, just everything is it's just going to ramp up, and it's going to be really hard for him to recover. So I think it's a huge game just based off of that. I think Nebraska has the tools to do it. I just think Illinois is in a better place right now, just in terms of being able to go out and execute.
Very interesting. So, Stu, I'm so fired up we had Joshua on this episode, especially to kick off the season. I think I've told Stu this story in the past, and I first got to know Joshua. Fox sent me down there to do interviews the week of the Big Ten title game when the year they won it. And they gave us some really good players. Ezekiel Elliott, right when he was about to break out, and Taylor Decker, and I think Pat Elflein. But I remember really hitting it off with Joshua. You could tell he was really different. And it's not even a decade later, and he's been nominated for an Emmy, and he has got all sorts of stuff, really cool things going on. And I know you have launched a podcast with your old teammate Evan Spencer. We'll give you a chance to plug that. I think it's Wednesdays, right?
Yep. So we're coming out on Wednesdays, and we're releasing 11 episodes. But it's a first person account of the 2014 season told from our perspective. And it's a really awesome project because I don't know if there have been many stories done like this on like a long form podcasting platform, but this story specifically really hasn't been told yet. And not from a player's the introduction from when Urban came in 2012 and a little background on that season, a little background on 2013, and then a deep dive into all of the ups and downs of the 2014 season. We're calling it Glory Days, Dreams and Nightmares, because it was a song we used to play in the locker room, Meek Mill song. But also when you characterize that season, we had some super bats and you have a player that unfortunately commits suicide. There are some real nightmares in there and some sleepless nights that we had. So we're super excited about the project and we appreciate everybody's support.
All right, Joshua, we say safe travels as we see you getting ready to get back on the road. We appreciate you taking the time and we'll hopefully see you on the road pretty soon.
Definitely.
Thank you, Josh.
Yeah. Okay, Stu, some very interesting thoughts from our Big Ten expert. So your conference team-by-team projections of what the records will be, both conference and overall, for the 2021 season are now out on The Athletic. And one of the schools that you had very far down, including finishing fifth, in the Big Ten East, is the Michigan Wolverines. You have them going 3-6 in the league play and 6-6, which, you know, indirectly probably doesn't make Jimmy Lake and the Washington fans feel all that great that you have them losing to a team that you think will be awful this year. You heard Joshua's thoughts on the Wolverines. Does that make you feel even more emboldened?
I don't actually think this is all that bold a record, because if you go back to last year, Michigan was 2-4 when their COVID cancellations started hitting. They were going to play Maryland, which I would have, you know, based on how those two teams played last year, was probably a toss-up game, but we'll give them the win. And then at Ohio State and at Iowa, they were going to lose both of those. So they probably would have finished 3-6 in the Big Ten last year. And
But you have Penn State 9-3, and Penn State had a really dreadful COVID 2020 season, so... Are you
But as Joshua mentioned, there were some everybody had to go through COVID, but some had it worse than others. You know, as we've talked about many, many times on here, Penn State had Micah Parsons opt out before the season and several other guys as well. Journey Brown, who was going to be their top running back, had health issues before the season even started, where he had to actually retire. Noah King gets hurt in the first game. So it was kind of an everything that could go wrong, did go wrong. The difference between Penn State and Michigan is Penn State did get better. They hit rock bottom, and then they ended on a four-game winning streak. You know, the last time Michigan played, they lost 27-17 to that Penn State team. May I remind you, they also lost 49-11 to Wisconsin and 38-21 to Indiana. They also lost to a pretty bad Michigan State team. So I guess I would ask you, like, what about that personnel? You know, I just don't think they have the personnel on defense to have some sort of dramatic improvement. It's not like he brought in some big wave of transfers here. They strike me as like a 500 kind of team.
I think they're better on defense, especially in the front seven, than I think maybe some people are giving them credit for. Aiden Hutchinson.
I'm more worried about the secondary and the cornerbacks.
I would be worried about the cornerbacks. To me, that is the biggest concern. Aiden Hutchinson, though, could be an All-American. He is a dominant front seven player who didn't get to play much last year. I think he and Mike McDonald's defense as a stand-up edge guy can be a big-time playmaker. I think they will be very good on the defensive line. Now, you got to remember, now they had opt-outs too, by the way. You're talking, I'm not saying, you know, Ambry Thomas, they really missed him. Daxton Hill will be one of the better defensive backs in the Big Ten, if not the country, at safety. I don't think they're going to be bad at safety because of the two guys they have there, and Brad Hawkins is pretty good, and Hill can be an All-American caliber player. It's corner that I would be worried about. To me, I think there's two things. Like, I don't think Michigan is going to be dramatically better than your 6-6. I think they can be an 8-win team, and maybe a little more than that, depending on, if they can find an identity on offense. Because right now, you know, one of the things that Joshua hit on, which I think was true, even back when you had 2 years ago, you know, you had a quarterback who came in, you know, came out of high school as a five-star guy, but they had a lot of turnovers. It was fumbles. It was just couldn't get out of their own way, couldn't get any momentum. So I think if Cade McNamara, again, it's probably not what Michigan fans are going to want to hear, because Jake Rudock was a good quarterback. He wasn't a great one, but he was a good one. And at least he could operate the system. And at those times, those Michigan teams were 10-win caliber teams. They were not as good as Ohio State, but they were definitely top 15, top 20 teams. I think they have a good group of receivers. I don't know if their running backs are going to be explosive or special. I know they have Donovan Edwards, who could be that at some point because he is a game breaker. Blake Corum is a really good, talented kid. I just don't know if they're, to me, I think that if you look at them and you look at them through the prism of, man, they looked awful and their cornerbacks had no confidence against Michigan State, no doubt, I would agree with that. I think the question is, where is the head of the guys in the secondary? Like, I say this, like, a couple of the guys I was around at and talked to at Michigan, between Josh Ross at linebacker and Aiden Hutchinson, I think their vibe, their leadership, and that maybe the accountability they are talking about felt a little different than maybe what we'd heard from people around Michigan in the last year or two. Like, something struck me about just the way you like talk, having a conversation with Josh Ross about why, you know, when I say Michigan State and what happened in that game, if a lot of guys in the locker room feel the way he feels, I think they will be better than, I certainly think they'll be better than 6-6. I'm not saying they'll beat Ohio State this year, but I think they may surprise some people.
All right. So let's say, you know, let's say that you said maybe 8-4.
Yeah, I would say maybe 8-4.
Are you including a win over Washington in that or no?
I am. So here's how I looked at it, because after you had sent me your number 6-6, and I obviously don't know what the six were, but their home games are Western Michigan, NIU, Rutgers, Northwestern, Indiana, Washington. Of those games, I would say there's three games they definitely should win. And then three that would fit in the category of toss-ups.
When I played it out, I have them beating Rutgers at home, then losing at Wisconsin, then winning, I actually have them losing at Nebraska, then beating Northwestern at home, so now they're at 2-2, beating Michigan State on the road to go 3-2, and that's when the bottom falls out because the back end of their schedule is tougher. Lose at Indiana, lose at Penn State, lose at Maryland, lose to Ohio State.
Okay, so I don't think they're going to beat Ohio State, and I don't think they're going to beat Penn State and State College. After that, I honestly think there are toss-ups.
You think they're going to win at Wisconsin?
No, I don't think they're going to win at Wisconsin, but the three games that I think would definitely fit into the category of toss-ups, Nebraska on the road, Indiana at home, and Maryland on the road. I could see them beating, honestly, I can see them beating Nebraska, and I can see them beating Maryland. I could see them losing to Indiana.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When you look at my Big Ten standings, who is too high? Who would you subtract a couple wins from?
Okay, I'm going to say that I am not as high on Minnesota as you are. I think they'll be better than they were last year, where they were really, really shaky, but I don't think I see them going 8-4. That seems a little overly optimistic to me. I think they'll be much better than they were on defense last year because they were really bad on defense, but I don't know. I'm a little skeptical of what I think, how good they'll be in the pass game on offense. Like a couple of years ago where they had terrific receivers outside and Tanner Morgan had a really excellent 2019. I'm not sure. I mean, also, obviously, they get out of the gate and they play Ohio State. I think they'll give Ohio State a game for a half, but after that, I don't think they'd keep up. And then I do think they'll win their other three non-conference games, though, or their three non-conference games.
Fair enough. So I'm going to be doing one of these conference previews, Power 5 conference previews, every day this week. And if you can give me a second to plug the Athletic's wealth of coverage. We did this last year. It was fun. We do a Heisman draft among the national writers and then see who had DeVonta Smith. Did anybody have DeVonta Smith last year? I had Jalen Waddle. Nobody drafted him. I had Jalen Waddle. Whoops.
Who won the Heisman draft last year?
I don't remember, but you should still follow this year.
Don't remember, huh?
With Matt Fortuna, David Ubben, you, Chris Vanini, Max Olson, Nicole Auerbach, Ari Wasserman, Andy Staples, and myself. The whole staff will make their playoff picks at the end of the week. I've got bowl projections next week. We have something really cool called the Hopometer. It's a survey. You fill it out, and we're going to get a gauge of which teams fans are feeling the most or least optimistic of their team. So if you haven't subscribed already, theathletic.com/theaudible for a discounted subscription. Speaking of which, Bruce had a very interesting story go up on Monday about the origins of Alabama's now lethal offense. And we've always heard, I've certainly written or read a lot about the Lane Kiffin impact when he got there in terms of shifting them to more of the hurry-up offense that Saban saw with Hugh Freeze and Kevin Sumlin, and he wanted some of it himself. But the interesting thing about your story is it's not that Kiffin like brought that with him. He came there kind of running the same offense, and Saban told him to go find out how to do this.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of layers to this. One of the things that was fascinating was, I mean, I talked to almost 24 guys who either coach there now or have coached there. And I think there's a lot of different versions of actually what happened, what was the impetus. One of the things that I was told that actually had a big role in steering it was when Lane Kiffin's first season there, when Blake Sims beats out Jacob Coker, both quarterbacks had a really hard time and were struggling picking up that system. Remember, Jake Coker had transferred in. He played for Jimbo Fisher at FSU. And Blake Sims had played slot receiver, defensive back, running back. He'd been bounced all over the place. And at one point, I'll let people kind of read into the weeds of this, but Lonnie Rosen, who's this psychiatry guru who works at Michigan State, who has known Nick Saban for 2 decades, and Nick Saban trusts implicitly, had basically talked to the offensive staff and at one point asked Lane Kiffin, okay, give me an example of one of your play calls. And, you know, from what I was told, Kiffin rattled off this like 20-syllable thing, and Lonnie Rosen was like apoplectic. And from that, you know, not long after that, a lot of analysts and guys on the offensive staff started doing a lot of research on a lot of different stuff to come up with more fastballs, which were the one-word play calls, to get into the Alabama offense, and it evolved from there. So I don't know. It was a really fascinating rabbit hole to go down, and I appreciate all the guys who took the time to kind of share their recollections of it. It was very interesting to jump into.
The funny thing is that there's so much that there was differing accounts entirely about whether Bill O'Brien had an influence in the original version or not. Now he's back as their OC. And everybody's wondering, you know, Saban always says, like, it's our offense. It's the Alabama offense. He almost makes it seem like the OCs are interchangeable, but clearly not. I mean, Sark you went from that RPO, like, when Tua was the quarterback, it felt like almost every play was an RPO. Sark went to more of the play action. What do we think and now Bill O'Brien takes over and has a new quarterback completely, and frankly, a lot of changeover on their offensive personnel. If you had to predict, what will be his biggest influence on the offense?
That's a good question. I don't know. My gut is it would be more like Brian Daboll, what he did bringing in the Patriots pass concepts. I think one of the things that I was told was big with Sark was also he throttled down a little bit. And some of that, I suspect, had to do with the difference between the top first line receivers and what else he had. I think he wanted those guys out on the field and wanted them a little fresher than going fastball where you're just going things as fast as possible. I mean, one thing that was interesting when I did talk to Lane Kiffin over the weekend for this story, and one of the things that he got, you know, they used a bunch of Oregon's old Chip Kelly Oregon stuff and Eagle stuff, and there was one particular play that he got from Kelly for the national title game where they beat Clemson. It was a game out in Arizona. And it's the first touchdown of the game is a 50-yard touchdown run by Derrick Henry. And so I had talked to Chip Kelly and asked him about, you know, kind of how that came about and what the play was. But it's interesting, when you find it online, they're going so fast that the broadcaster almost misses it because they go from a replay, all of a sudden the ball is snapped right at the spot. And I know if you're, you know, obviously if you're the producer of the game, you're probably having a heart attack because you would have missed the beginning of the game's first touchdown because you were, you know, coming out of a replay because they were going so fast.
All right. We're going to get to the mailbag here in a second. I know people don't like, you know, a lot of people don't like we ever even mentioned COVID on this podcast, but we are on the brink of the first games, and it is back in the news. First of all, Auburn coach Brian Harsin is currently isolating. He has COVID. And Andy Staples with a little bit of an interesting scoop on Monday. So you've watched each of the conferences announce their forfeit policies. They're pretty universal. If a team can't field enough players because of a COVID outbreak, they're going to have to forfeit. Clearly, the leagues are trying to incentivize getting as many guys as possible vaccinated. The SEC one has an interesting little twist, though. If a forfeit or more than one forfeit were to cause the SEC to have to give up some of its TV revenue, the team that had to forfeit would take the hit. So not only would you take a loss, you'd have to take a little bit of a financial loss as well. I wonder, to me, that seems like, Sankey has not been shy about the importance of wanting these teams to get vaccinated. And a lot of them have. Lane Kiffin, 100% on his team. I think Alabama and Georgia are very high. But it's an interesting, you know, that didn't come up, obviously, last year when a lot of games were canceled and a lot of conferences probably made less money. They weren't going to hold an individual school responsible for that. But clearly, they feel pretty strongly this year that if you can't field enough players, that's your problem. I personally don't think there's going to be many, if any, forfeits. Obviously, it's not that vaccinated. I mean, we know vaccinated people can get COVID. That's happening. Breakthrough infections are happening plenty. But if you have most of your players vaccinated, the biggest difference between last year and this year is the contact tracing. How many times I felt like every week on Big Noon Kickoff, you had to like track down how many players a team was going to be missing because of contact tracing. I don't believe there is contact tracing if you're vaccinated, so that should help keep the number of players missing to a pretty modest amount.
All right, Stu, we're getting to the mailbag. As always, send your questions to the audiblepod@gmail.com. This first question, Stu, is from Matt. Love listening to your show. Thank you, Matt. So my question is about Matt Campbell and the amount of love Iowa State is getting to start the year. Let's first rewind the clock. Going into the 2012 football season, K-State had just won 10 games, had everyone returning on their team, and had Bill Snyder as their head football coach. We started the season, he says, ranked in the low 20s with five Big 12 teams ahead of us. We went on to win the Big 12 that year. So fast forward to now, Iowa State is bringing everyone back, and they had their first great season in an extremely weird college football season. However, they seem to be the darling of the national media. Au contraire, Matt. I'm looking at a man across the Zoom from me who is definitely not looking at them with loving eyes. as a case.
A man who has them number 7 in his preseason college football.
But thinks they have no chance of going to the playoff and winning a game.
Who thinks they have no chance of winning a playoff game.
Okay.
Much like 125 other college football programs. Go ahead.
You're saying that it's just about just like everybody else do. You're peeing in the oatmeal again. As a K-State fan, it's hard not to be jealous. Does Matt Campbell have a very good PR team? Does Bill Snyder just not play along with reporters enough? For two schools that feel very similar in certain ways, they couldn't be treated more differently. What gives, Stu?
I found this question fascinating. I went back and looked up the 2012 early preseason AP poll. First of all, Bruce, quick, off without thinking about it, where do you think Ohio State was ranked in the 2012 preseason poll?
They might have been unranked. Was that the first? That was the Luke Fickle.
That was Urban's first team.
Okay, so then I would think they were on. They couldn't play for the season though, right? So would they not be in one of the polls?
No, they could be in the AP preseason.
Okay,
poll.
So I would guess they were ranked like 19th.
Oh wow. Yeah, 18th.
I knew how much he loved Braxton Miller. I worked with him briefly at ESPN. I just remember him gushing about Braxton Miller when he was out.
Just to show you, college football does still go through some cycles. Number 9 was South Carolina, and number 10 was Arkansas. Okay, the Big 12 teams that were ahead. And I was surprised at this because I distinctly remember doing a story on K-State in 2011 when they won 10 games, and I think they started like 8-0. And it was like, oh, Bill Snyder still got it. Remember, he was pretty early into his second stint. So it surprises me they didn't get more respect going into the 2012 season. The Big 12 teams that were ranked ahead of them, Oklahoma at number 4, not a really surprise there. West Virginia in its first year in the Big 12, number 11. They were coming off that 70-33 or 70. I don't remember Clemson's score. I just remember West Virginia had 70. Yeah. Texas, number 15. Oklahoma State, that had won the Big 12 the year before but lost Brandon Whedon and Justin Blackman, number 19. TCU, also in its first year in the Big 12, number 20. That's the one I'm a little baffled at. I think what happened was a combination of two things. People were really got ahead of themselves on West Virginia and TCU and underestimated that they were going to take a little time to adjust to their new conference. And then the difference between Matt Campbell and Bill Snyder is pretty simple to me. Bill Snyder was a proven commodity. He'd been doing it for a long time. Matt Campbell is still fairly new on the scene. He's the hot new coach. This is uncharted territory for Iowa State, whereas Kansas State came, as we know, came very close to reaching the national title game at one point. So I don't think it has anything to do with how the coaches interact with the media. It's not like I don't think Matt Campbell is friendly with the media, but I don't think of him as like a Steve Spurrier type. I just think it's that Snyder had been there, done that, and Matt Campbell's new on the scene. And if you believe Bruce, he's the second coming of Vince Lombardi. And if you believe me, he's a very, very, very good coach who it would be a tremendous accomplishment if Iowa State, which has never won the Big 12, wins the Big 12 this year.
I also think a couple of things. That Iowa State team right now, I mean, to me, clearly they are one of the two best programs in the conference. I feel like they have separated in the past year or plus. Now, I know that they're not light years better than the rest of them, but I don't feel like the Big 12 at the top is as competitive as it was back when what you were just talking about, Stu, at this point.
I think the Big 12 at that time was a lot more respected as a conference because they were not that far. They were still not that far. They just lost Nebraska the year before, I think. I just think the respect level top to bottom was a lot higher.
Well, we also at that point, remember, coming out of 2011, Texas had not just fallen off the map at
Correct.
That point.
Oklahoma State had just finished number 3 in the country.
Yeah.
It was considered a tough conference. I think that respect has faded a lot since Oklahoma has become, you know, just dominating the conference. That being said, I actually think the Big 12 this year has a chance to be the second best conference in the country. Because we just went over the Big 10 and there just weren't a lot of teams that outside of Ohio State and maybe Wisconsin that give you like a lot of confidence. I'm very confident.
So who are the teams that give you a lot of confidence beyond Oklahoma and Iowa State?
I'm not sure who it's going to be exactly, but I think amongst a pretty deep group, of Oklahoma State, TCU, Texas, and possibly even West Virginia, one or more of those teams is going to emerge as a top 15 type team.
Do you feel like Iowa State is considerably a notch better than Wisconsin, Iowa, and
yes.
Penn State?
Yes.
You feel okay? I didn't. So you feel like the top two in the Big 12 is noticeably better than the top than whoever.
Well,
the top
I think
two
that the top team in each conference, Oklahoma and Ohio State, are on fairly even.
I thought you thought Wisconsin and Iowa State were comparable.
I do actually. Although I have Iowa State higher than Wisconsin. I think I just.
So where's the 3, 4, 5?
Well, I think it's more about depth. I think the Big 12 is going to go about 7 deep in terms of, they're not all going to finish in the top 25, but top 25 caliber teams. The Big
really?
10, which has 4 more teams in it, so let's take that as a factor. I think you've got Wisconsin, Iowa, Ohio State, Penn State, Indiana. Those are 5, with maybe Minnesota as a 6th. You've got teams like Rutgers, Michigan State, Michigan, Maryland. Like, you've just got more mediocre to bottom in the Big 10 than in the Big 12, where I think the only quote-unquote bad teams are Baylor, Texas Tech, and Kansas.
Okay.
By the way, they really whiffed, the voters really whiffed on that 2012 Kansas State team. I looked it up. He wasn't kidding. They had their whole offense coming back, led by Colin Klein and a receiver you may have heard of named Tyler Lockett. And then on defense, do you remember Arthur Brown?
I do. It was Bryce Brown's brother.
Yep. Do you remember Nigel Malone? Ty Zimmerman?
I actually don't remember those players.
Well, it was a pretty good team. I that year, I just happened to cover there when they beat Oklahoma and when they beat West Virginia, who was very highly ranked. But then I also had the Fiesta Bowl where they got their butts kicked by, I still think the best.
Kelly's last game.
I still think that was the best of his teams, the 2012 team, but they lost in overtime at home to Stanford and kept them out of the national title game. Next question comes from Rick Pieros in San Luis Obispo. Greetings, Bruce and Stu. I thoroughly enjoy the Audible and look forward to it each week. Thank you, Rick. However, as a Utah Ute fan, I am continually disappointed by the lack of any talk about the Utes as playoff contenders or dark horse. The only mention they seem to get is that, quote, they will contend for the South. Then the conversation inevitably turns to USC or ASU or Oregon. For a team that just missed the playoff a couple years ago by laying an uncharacteristic egg against Oregon, they seem to get no respect and little mention. What gives?
I think they will be very good on both lines, and I think they will be very good on defense. But I don't know if they are going to be explosive enough. You and I both really like Britton Covey personally, but I just don't know if I... And look, Brant Keithy, when I remember talking to some coaches in the league, they think he is one of the most underrated players in the country. They can do a lot with him, move him around. He's a matchup nightmare. But I'm not sure I think they have enough firepower to be a real playoff contender.
I don't know if they can be a playoff contender, but I certainly think they could win. I mean, they are my favorite to win the South, and then obviously that makes their chances of winning the Pac-12 very good, which they haven't actually done yet, which I think is part of the, you know, they continue to probably get less respect than they've earned. But part of that is that laying the egg against Oregon, or the year before when they scored 3 points against Washington in the Pac-12 title game. The one thing I'll say about Utah, well, two things. First of all, I assumed Charlie Brewer had already run away with the job. It has turned into a legit two-man race with Cam Rising, the former Texas quarterback. And as of this recording, Kyle Whittingham hasn't named the starter. Maybe it'll come here soon. I think that's probably a good sign, because I think if there's somebody capable of possibly beating out a four-year Big 12 starter, that's a good sign. And then the other thing about Utah is they got a lot of possible impact transfers, whether it's not just Brewer, but TJ Pledger at running back. Theo Howard, who you may remember from UCLA, the receiver, he transferred to Oklahoma last year but was hurt and barely played. You talk about explosive. I feel like he could possibly be that guy for them. So I see them winning at least 9 games and maybe more. And I think that's probably the respect that Rick is looking for.
I think also, you know, we should mention, you know, look, one of the rising stars in the Pac-12 was one of the best freshmen in the country last year, Ty Jordan. They're terrific young running back who passed away. And, you know, I don't know how they, you know, what their answers are in terms of in the backfield going forward with, you know, I think he was going to be a big time playmaker for them. And so we'll see. A couple of years ago on that team that, that Rick mentioned, having been around that group, especially, I mean, they had a terrific running game. Tyler Huntley was a really good underrated college quarterback. I think, you know, I don't know if they have that kind of capability in terms of, like, they want to be physical, they want to run the football like that. We'll see. I mean, that, I don't know if they have that. I don't know if they're going to have that right now.
The other thing I should just say about the, I think the Pac-12 could be absolutely crazy this year, because we are trying our best to assess teams that we saw play 4 to 5 games last year. Utah played 5 games, and like you said, the absolute revelation of their season was Ty Jordan, and you figured he'd be like the face of the team coming into this year, and then awful tragedy. So, you know, how do you really know, like, for instance, Washington? A lot of people are very high on Washington. They played 4 games last year. Cal played 4 games last year. So, to me, you're almost basing it on a bunch of guys who you've barely seen play, or guys who are like a Britton Covey who's been around forever. Last one, Bruce, from Reem, and thank you for telling us how you pronounce your name. Howdy, y'all. Love the show, but wanted to ask, who are some teams y'all think have the most difference between their floor and the ceiling this year? So a team that's floor is probably 5 wins, but the ceiling is 11, for example. As an LSU student, I say we definitely feel like we're in that category. I would agree with him. LSU could contend, could win the SEC, and I wouldn't be shocked, and could go 5-7, and I wouldn't be shocked.
I think some of that has to do with you have new coordinators, and they're unproven commodities at this point, right? So I'm excited. My TV crew is going to have their opener against UCLA, not this weekend, but next weekend. And that'll be a very intriguing matchup. I would put Penn State in that category, to be honest. So much is dependent, as Joshua said, Sean Clifford. I don't know how good they are behind him if he does get injured also, but like third coordinator in 3 years, that's a tall order. I think they have some good, really good pieces around him, but you know, if they don't get a lot better on a quarterback, I think the Big Ten is strong enough where they could have some battles. But I think they're, if he does play really well, and he's played more than almost, you know, if you look at the teams that are real Big Ten title contenders, he's played more than any quarterback that's in there, you know, like he and Tanner Morgan. So it's, you know, to me they would be high on that list. I don't know if I would go, you know, like to me, I don't know if I'd say Ole Miss could be an 11-win team, but I think they could be a 9 or 10, or they could be a 5-win team because they were so horrible on defense last year. And quite honestly, Matt Corral does some terrific things, but he's had a couple of games where he's turned the ball over a ton, you know? So I think they are another one I would fit in the category of like, they could be all over the board because they were just so bad on defense. And I don't know that their personnel aren't, like, LSU was terrible on defense last year, but I know they have a really good D-line and they have very talented corners. They should be a lot better on defense unless communication completely falls apart or they get a lot of injuries. Ole Miss, I don't know that they have really some difference maker guys there to get significantly better on defense. But the expectations, there's a bunch of people who I think are picking Ole Miss to be a top 15 kind of team. So to me, I would put them definitely in that category. And you know what? I would actually say UCLA might be a team that could be, you know, wildly all over the place. We haven't seen them have a breakout year under Chip Kelly. They have a lot of guys back. They have a talented quarterback who has not been consistent in Dorian Thompson-Robinson. I think they can really run the football, but we need to see it. To me, they could be a 10-win team, or they could probably have been a 5-win team.
All right, I got several candidates in mind, including in the. This is telling me it's going to be an exciting season in the SEC because we mentioned LSU, you mentioned Ole Miss. I got a couple more SEC teams to throw into the mix. One is Florida. you know, I've been feeling all along that they would take a little bit of a step back from last season because of all the kind of the wipeout on offense. But I could be wrong. And Dan Mullen's like,
do you think they could be a 5-win team though?
Well, does it have to be those exact numbers? I'm thinking that.
No, but I mean, do you think?
I think they could.
Do you think their ceiling is that low though?
Yeah, because if the defense is as bad as it was last year, but without the Kyle Trask, you know, 40-50 point a game offense, if it's more of a just okay offense with Emory Jones, then yeah, in that conference, absolutely, you could go 6-6 or so. But that's probably underselling Dan Mullen as a great offensive coach. He will probably have Emory Jones ready to go.
I don't think you've looked at their schedule then. Because to me, unless they are horrific on offense, they have Florida Atlantic at home, USF, who's been really bad. They play Tennessee at home. Tennessee's been really bad. They get Vanderbilt at home. So right now they got 4 wins without really doing much of anything. And then they have South Carolina, who we don't think is going to be that good. Samford, who's there. And then Mizzou and Florida State. Like, I don't think they have to do all that much to get to 7 wins. Like, they could be really bad on off. Like, they could be really underwhelming on offense. They're still probably going to win 7 games.
Probably, as I'm looking at it now.
I don't think their ceiling is actually that
low. The everything goes could go wrong, goes wrong scenario would be you lose, obviously, to Alabama. I think at Kentucky is a...
you don't need everything to go
chalk
wrong.
Chalk that one up as an L regardless. And then the everything could go wrong scenario is you lose at Kentucky, which is certainly possible, at LSU, Georgia. I think Missouri on the road is not an automatic win. And then I have no idea whether they... Florida State will be a team that could win that game or not. The other SEC team I want to mention, I have absolutely no idea what to expect from Auburn. This isn't based on personnel. This is just based on what Brian Harsin's going to be doing there is a kind of a complete mystery. You're used to their identity under Gus Malzahn all these years. You tell me Auburn goes 4-8, I'll believe you. You tell me Auburn goes 10-2, I'll believe you. And then the other one is Washington, who a lot of people are very high on. Ryan Leaf put out his Pac-12 predictions on Twitter. He has Washington going 12-0. But again, we watched them for 4 games last year. And the thing that concerns me about, I think they have a lot of talent. I think we've talked about this on here before. We're not all that high on either of Jimmy Lake's coordinator hires, John Donovan on offense, promoting Bob Gregory on defense. Dylan Morris, I think, looked pretty good last year. Will he hold on to that job? I don't know. Do they have receivers? I'm going to pick them to go like 9-3 or 8-4, but the fact that I had them losing to Michigan, and I don't think Michigan's going to be that good, tells you my confidence level in them. All right, Bruce, hey, it's game week. We got into Nebraska, Illinois a little bit with Joshua, but it's not the only game here on week 0. Tell me which one of the other games you're most interested in.
Okay, I am going to give you, can I give you 3?
Okay, then just, there's only 5, so just tell us how you feel about all of them.
I'm very curious about Fresno State. I think Kellen DeBoer was a really good hire. For people who are around him in the Big Ten when he was a coordinator there, think he's really, really good. He has a lot of skill guys. You remember Jake Haner? He was the quarterback at Washington. He transferred there. Ronnie Rivers, really good running back. They have really good skill guys. By the way, Ty Jones, I think people remember him from Washington. He was a big receiver who never broke out. So this is Randy Edsall's first game in like almost 2 years for UConn. It's going to be a rough road trip, but I think Fresno State is a team that we may be talking about as a top 25 team out of the Mountain West, because I think they're going to be really good on offense.
The UConn part is just fascinating. I mean, they're almost like, it's almost like when UAB shut down football and came back. UConn has been on the sideline for 2 years. The last time we saw them, they were absolutely terrible. So it's like how much improvement was Randy Edsall able to make kind of behind the scenes, having a basically like 2 years of training camp. But just to remind you, the last time UConn played in 2019, they went 2-10. They lost, let's see here, some of the highlights of that season, if you will. A 49-7 loss at Tulane, a 56-10 loss to Navy, a 48-3 loss to Cincinnati, and they ended it with a 49-17 loss to Temple. Their only wins that year were against Wagner and UMass. So, I mean, my guess is this won't be a particularly close game unless he's brought in some ringers since 2019.
Well, he does have one of my top freaks in the country. Travis Jones is a massive D lineman who NFL scouts are very interested in. Travis is going to have his hands full. He could be disrupting the whole interior of the line. I just think there's too much for Fresno State. Two other quick ones. Keep an eye on UTEP at New Mexico State. Jonah Johnson has a big NFL arm. A lot of people compare him. He is the New Mexico State quarterback. Compare him to David Garrard. You remember him. So he has some connections also to David Garrard. He's one to watch. And then, Stu, a game that is in your backyard. I believe you will be covering the Southern Utah at San Jose State game for The Athletic. True?
Ooh, it hadn't even occurred to me that that game is here. What I'm puzzled about is I teed you up to mention any game you want besides Nebraska-Illinois, and the only one you didn't mention was Hawaii-UCLA.
Because we've talked about UCLA a lot on this podcast, so I figured that was kind of off the board.
I'm excited for any you know, San Jose State, Nick Starkle. I'm excited just to see them back on the field. UTEP, New Mexico State, I mean, I think the biggest storyline there is, can you find this game on your television? Because it's on Bally Sports / something called Flow Football. We come back on the podcast Monday. I want to know, Bruce, all I'm going to want to know is, were you able to watch your beloved UTEP New Mexico State game?
I am going to have to peristyle it. I think I'm going to have to fire up peristyle for the first time in like 2 years. Periscope.
Yes.
Yeah, peristyle, I think, is at USC.
I don't even know if Periscope exists anymore, but I get what you're saying.
I'm going to give you a name to know for when you're at Spartan Stadium for the San Jose State game.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna have to read it slowly. La'akea Kaho Ohano Davis. He is a linebacker for Southern Utah, and I probably should add him on my freaks list. I actually watched him last night. Freaky athlete, was a great track athlete from Hawaii. He could play in the Pac-12, I think. So Nick Starkle will probably be seeing a lot of him. Now, Southern Utah wasn't very good last year. They were 1-5, so I'm not going to try to sell you that they're going to have some breakout year. But keep an eye on him.
If you didn't see San Jose State last year, and I bet a lot of people didn't, even though they were good because their season started so late and whatnot, you know who Nick Starkle is. But they've got a defensive end, Cade Hall, who is just an absolute badass pass rusher. When I would watch them last year, it was hard to miss him. He ended up with 10 sacks in 8 games. He's back for his umpteenth year. So Mountain West Defensive Player of the Year. So if you do tune into that game at 10 p.m. Eastern on CBS Sports Network, keep an eye out for him. And by the way, next week, week 1, San Jose State at USC.
Are you going to go to the game or not?
Bruce, I'm not going to go to the game. I'm sorry about that.
How many chances are you going to have to see Southern Utah play in person?
It's not so much that as how many. I think there'll be more chances to see San Jose State in an actual competitive game. So, anyway,
Week 0, Stu, be out there, man.
I did go to a Week 0 San Jose State game in 2017. They hosted Charlie Strong's USF team. I got to see Quentin Flowers in the flesh. Have you? When's the last time you went to a game at San Jose State?
Do you remember Neil Perry?
Yeah, that's what I thought you were going to say. That was a long time ago. Let me tell you something. Their stadium is no nicer now than it was then.
I cannot drive there. You could drive there. So
it's an interesting window into when they talk about the haves and have-nots. San Jose State is on the extreme end of have-nots. Their stadium is a high school stadium. When I went to that game in 2017, there were like 2 concession stands, and I went to one of them at halftime, and they were already out of all the food. It's kind of depressing. Now, that was when they were really bad. Maybe it'll be more fired up this year now that they're good, and obviously the fans can be back in the stands. So
I remember going through there. I went to see Charles Clark, who is a old Ole Miss player. I know he's a coach, and he was on Mike McIntyre's staff. I went in to see him. I didn't know Mike McIntyre at the time. They had just gone 1-12. For some reason, they played 13 games that year, and they just got slaughtered by like Alabama and Wisconsin. They played all these physical teams, and then they like, you know, their roster was depleted. And then credit to McIntyre, he got it going. But you're right, it's hard to sustain at a place like that.
As always, you can send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. When we come back next week, it will be week 1. Can't wait. See you next time.